everybody here. And what I decided to do is to talk about a long-standing interest and a series of works in progress, which is aimed at the foundations of quantum mechanics and the relationship between the foundations of quantum mechanics and gravity. So I hope here it needs no apology. One needs no apology to be doing that. That's, of course, the whole point of perimeter. So what I'm going to be talking about is partly an argument about how quantum mechanics and the problems of space and time might reconcile themselves, and partly a series of calculations which aim to investigate some claims that have been made about different approaches to the foundations of quantum mechanics. So more directly, and I don't have a pointer, but so if somebody has a pointer somewhere, or can tell me where one is, I wouldn't mind. I'm going to spend a few minutes on motivation, because the point of view here, although I think of it as a very natural point of view, is not the one that most of us take. Indeed, it's not the one that I've taken in most of my own work. And then I'm going to talk about, and the motivation is going to lead to interest in the idea that quantum mechanics might not be a fundamental theory, as the title indicates, but might be an approximation to another theory in the sense of a low-energy effective description of the physics of a different theory. And that sort of particle physics-y, condensed matter-y, low-energy approximation to is implicit through a number of the arguments in the talk. I'm going to focus attention on a proposal from the 1960s for foundations of quantum mechanics called Nelson's quantum mechanics. And for people who don't know it, I'll be introducing it here. And the reason to do that is because it's a formulation of quantum mechanics based directly on stochastic dynamics or stochastic differential equations. So the idea that quantum mechanics is a statistical theory which might arise as the approximation to another theory. So it's a natural setting to investigate that question. Nelson's formulation has been mysterious since he proposed it in the 1960s. I should say it stands in a nice sort of contrast to Bohmian mechanics, which is the most developed and most studied realistic or hidden variables alternative to quantum mechanics. But I think as opposed to Bohm, which we understand what it asserts, and the issue is just, does it assert something that would allow us to distinguish it from quantum mechanics? Because, I mean, that's the focus of a lot of work of Antony Valentini and other people in the field. I think we've never really understood Nelson. So part of what I'm interested in doing is make a stab at how Nelson's claim could be true. As you'll see, Nelson's claim is that quantum mechanics is an ordinary statistical mechanics system with some unusual conditions imposed on the conservation of energy, particularly. So how could that possibly be true? Well, I think I know, and I'm going to explain it to you. And maybe it's an obvious point, but it was not obvious, I think, to many of us, at least to me. Then clearing that up, it'll be clear what needs to happen if this statistical formulation of quantum mechanics is to be derived from a more fundamental theory. And I'm going to go through a sketch of a derivation focusing on a key issue. And I'll tell you in advance, the key issue is going to be time reversal invariance. And that is where the main conclusions of the talk are. Basically, in understanding what has to be true about a more fundamental theory so that quantum mechanics might emerge as a low-energy description of subsystems of that theory. Then, if there's time, there are two other topics. One of them is there's a long-standing objection to Nelson's approach to quantum mechanics by Wallström, and this has been the subject of vigorous debate here with a number of people here, Antony, Lucien, Joy and other people. And I'm going to present a discussion of that in the context of a simple example, and I expect that some people may have something to say about it, and I know what they have to say, but they'll tell you what they have to say. And then if there's time, I'll discuss two models which are studied, which we've been studying to realize these ideas. One, a model of, in which the degrees of freedom are particles that we studied with Fortini a few years ago, and one, a lattice statistical system, or what would be an underlying statistical system for quantum field theory, which is under study. Okay, and I'm also going to discuss works of Yudan and how Finkel, which are relevant to the motivation. Okay. So I take the point of view that the foundations of quantum mechanics are an unsolved problem, and that among other problems, particularly the measurement problem, drives me crazy. And I should say that, I mean, there's very occasionally I've glimpsed the possibility of feeling that quantum mechanics is okay. The last time that happened was when I read a paper of Olaf Dreyer recently, and I had for a few hours the idea, oh, maybe it's really okay and quantum mechanics really makes sense as it is. But then I woke up the next morning and that went away. So at least I'm somebody who is unable to be satisfied with the issue of the measurement problem, and thus unable to be satisfied for various reasons with various approaches to it, like many worlds, consistent histories. And we can save that argument for the discussion. But even if you're satisfied with ordinary quantum mechanics, there are issues when it comes to applying quantum mechanics to cosmology that are even more knotty, because then you don't have the possibility of using a language where the observers and the clocks and the measuring instruments are outside the system under study. Everything has to be part of a closed system, so that there are additional problems trying to extend quantum mechanics to a complete system that includes the observer and measuring instruments. Now, I should say, before I give up on that, that there are approaches in progress aimed at solving that problem. And I mentioned three there by Fortini, by Chris Isham, by Lucian. And there are others. So what I'm going to be saying for the rest of the talk is under the assumption that those approaches fail and quantum mechanics cannot be made sense of when applied to cosmology. And Raphael also has a long-standing approach to that in terms of modified notions of probability and path integrals. Okay, so I take it as given that none of these great people and friends succeed in their research programs. Okay, so what if none of them work? And then it means that quantum mechanics is not the fundamental theory when we try to describe a theory of cosmology, a theory of the whole universe. Well, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in quantum information theory that it's been very interesting to learn about here. And it's not the only view, but one view that seems to resonate through the quantum information community is that quantum mechanics is just a formalization of the information that we have about systems. Not everybody agrees with that, but some people advocate it in one form or another, like Chris Fuchs and Anton Zeilinger. And if you accept that, the question is then, is that good enough, or does one give up on the idea of what a philosopher would call a realist description of the system, or is one happy with I'm not quite sure what the word is, but a Fuchsian or Zeilingerian description of physics? Well, again, I'm going to assume that the answer is no, but then raise a question, because as physicists, if we believe that quantum mechanics is to be superseded by another theory, the important question to ask is, what are the limits? That is, what are the physical scales involved where quantum mechanics will be superseded? Might it be, you know, things having to do with gravity, which is what Roger Penrose investigates? Or there are various approaches to spontaneous collapse that posit various things as to what the limits of quantum mechanics are, or equilibrium, as Antony Valentini postulates, the notion of disequilibrium. So it seems that if the key issue is extending quantum mechanics to cosmology, the parameter that should govern where quantum mechanics breaks down is what proportion of the whole universe is being described. So roughly speaking, the ratio of the number of degrees of freedom in the system you're studying to the number of degrees of freedom in the cosmology or cosmological theory or model. So that hypothesis there at the bottom of the screen underlies, I won't always explicitly mention it, but it underlies the different ideas that follow. That quantum mechanics will break down for systems which are large, which become sizable compared to the universe as a whole, which of course might make us worry about experimental tests and distinguishing. Okay, now, what do we know, assuming that there is a quantum theory, a theory that supersedes quantum mechanics? What do we know about it? We know there are some tiny loopholes left in the argument about Bell's theorem and non-locality in the experiments and so forth, but I am not impressed by them. And so I think we know that such a theory will be explicitly non-local, and in the additional degrees of freedom that are added to have a realist description, the so-called hidden variables, their interactions will manifestly violate relativistic invariance and locality. Okay, that's the conclusion of a lot of discussion, but I think I'm going to take the point of view that that's been had. In addition, if we think about what information there is really in a wave function comprising a large component of the universe, or a quantum state comprising a large component of the universe, there's an enormous network of non-local entanglement, which has been building up and developing as the universe evolved. And that somehow must be represented in this theory. And the theory must also account for another set of non-local properties, which are the Bose and Fermi statistics of the different identical particles. So here's a hypothesis. And the hypothesis is that the additional degrees of freedom, the hidden variables, are relational. And relational is a word that resonates for people in gravitational theory and theories of space-time. In this context, it means that if one wants to have the correct realistic theory of an isolated system, say some atoms in an experiment, one does not complexify the description of those atoms, for example, as one does in Bohm theory by having both the waves and the particles as physical degrees of freedom. One looks for new degrees of freedom that relate or connect the local degrees of freedom we know of with other faraway local degrees of freedom. That is, we have a more detailed description not of individual systems, but of the relationships of individual systems to the rest of the system. So that's a postulate or a hypothesis. And that's really governed by the idea that the theory that we're looking for is one where new effects come in when the subsystem becomes comparable to the size of the system, which is the universe as a whole. So what's missing are hidden variables. What's postulated to be missing are hidden variables that connect the subsystem to the universe as a whole. Okay, now an obvious point, a theory, any hidden variable theory, it seems, unless those little loopholes in the Bell argument work out, is explicitly non-local and explicitly violates relativistic causality in the interactions amongst the hidden variables. And this has been realized in Bohmian mechanics without upsetting the framework of space and time, but it certainly seems, that certainly seems peculiar, because it seems that if one is positing that there are new non-local degrees of freedom or non-local interactions, that that should challenge our notion of what is local and not what is not local, and anything that challenges relativistic causality should challenge our understanding of the primacy of general relativity in the space-time continuum, and so forth. Okay, so it seems good advice, if we're going to get this crazy, to not only try to modify quantum mechanics, but to do it in the context of modifying the theory of space and time as well. That is, there seems to be, we should take seriously this conflict between locality and non-locality. I'm not going to take many questions, but I will take one from Joy. By what? I mean, for example, and if I would have had more time to prepare, I would have put this in explicitly, the theorem of Antony, that there is non-local signaling out of equilibrium in a large class of hidden variable theories. Okay. So what does space-time theory, our attempts to understand space-time and combine it with quantum mechanics, what do they tell us about the possibility of non-locality, relational, hidden variables, and so forth? Well, first, there is already what many of us take to be a convincing argument that a fundamental theory of space-time must be what Leibniz and scholars in philosophy call relational, what physicists call background independent. And I'm not going to repeat that argument here, but again, we can have it in discussion. All of this is motivation. Second, there is already an expectation brought out in different theories that in practice, background-independent approaches to quantum gravity, that is, approaches to quantum gravity that do not describe objects or fields or strings moving in classical space-time, are not formulated in the language of geometry at all. They're formulated in languages of algebra and combinatorics. And that's common to all the interesting approaches on the table, causal sets, spin foam, loop quantum gravity, and matrix models of M theory and string theory and dynamical triangulations. And that point is worth emphasizing. Proposals for fundamental formulations or background independent, or Brian Greene is now calling manifestly background independent formulations of string theory and M theory, have been formulated completely algebraically in terms of matrices. And these are already explicitly non-local in the degrees of freedom. In these theories, the fundamental degrees of freedom are some set of matrices. The local degrees of freedom that correspond to particles and local fields correspond to eigenvalues of those matrices, and the matrix elements themselves correspond to non-local correlations or degrees of freedom between those local degrees of freedom. And that's something that people who work on these models know and puzzle over, and it's been proposed in the literature more than once that perhaps one shouldn't quantize matrix formulations of M theory. One should derive quantum mechanics from them because they're already non-local theories. And there are two of several papers that have studied that. Okay. Now, however, any such approach, in whatever context, in which space is not and geometry are not primary, and some algebraic combinatorial description is primary, has the problem of the emergence of space as the key problem that has to be demonstrated. And there are difficulties and issues. That's, of course, the key problem that people in spin foam models and loop quantum gravity and causal sets and dynamical triangulations and M theory and so on worry about, is how does one derive classical geometry as a low energy effective description of these fundamental degrees of freedom. And there are some successes in each of these research programs that say that if you massage things in the right way and put on the right kind of conditions, you begin to see notions appropriate to local field theory emerging. But there are some criticisms of that. And there's a set of criticisms developed by Fotini, these are in her paper, so I won't also go into this in detail, that argue that in many of these theories, it won't work. That is, unless one imposes, let me step back and say, in all these theories, there's a microscopic notion of locality coming from the fundamental degrees of freedom in their interactions, for example, the graphs in spin networks or in spin foams or in causal sets. And then there's hypotheses to be a emergent low-energy notion of locality that comes from some emergent low-energy description described in terms of a metric on a manifold and fields and so forth. And the point is that these need not coincide even if the emergent description does emerge. It's still not guaranteed that there's a 100% correspondence between the two notions of locality. And I'll develop some of that argument now. Okay, so first, some obvious points. It's easy to approximate continuous structures by discrete structures. For example, we can triangulate surfaces and manifolds. However, it's hard to go back. That is, if one sticks together random collections of triangles according to some rules, almost nothing in that random collection in an ensemble of randomly stuck together triangles looks like a manifold or behaves statistically like a manifold, or nor do degrees of freedom on them behave statistically like degrees of freedom on a manifold, unless you impose some pretty stringent conditions to ensure that it happens. The reason why is pretty easy to see. Supposing that I have some combinatorial degrees of freedom, for example, supposing my degrees of freedom are a graph, and I have beat on the thing hard enough and long enough that the state of the system is peaked around a nice local lattice like this. But it comes out of a configuration space which has all possible graphs in it. So let's think about its neighborhood in its native, that is, microscopic configuration. Okay, so let's add a link randomly. There are the number of dimensions times the number of links, roughly, ways of adding a link that's consistent with the notion of locality established by the lattice, but there are n squared ways that do not. So in the native configuration space of the combinatorial theory, matching a low-dimensional version of locality, that is, having your state be peaked around a lattice or triangulation that looks like an approximation of a local lattice, is unstable. There are many more ways to violate it than preserve it. And this is, one way or another, at the root of why all the different research programs that have to come up with a low-energy limit, which is a manifold from something else, have trouble doing so. Although, again, some of them, there are some interesting results where there has been progress made. So a hypothesis is that the matching is incomplete. Now, there's two versions of this. There's the radical version of it in which there's a notion of locality that emerges from the quantum states that has little to do with the local structure of the graph. And there's a conservative point of view that says, let's just investigate small deviations where there are mismatches of the two notions of locality. And I'm a conservative, or at least I don't have the same courage that Fotini and other people have to investigate the more radical thing. So I want to investigate the conservative point of view. The conservative point of view is that the graphs which dominate, and again, this is in any of these approaches, from matrix formulations of M theory to spin networks to causal sets, et cetera, looks almost local. That is, there's a small proportion of edges which, if you remove them, you will have a low-dimensional local structure. And so there's a contamination or a disordering of a local structure by non-local connections. Now, it turns out that people in statistical physics have been studying those for some years, and they call them small world networks. So there's an actual category of statistical mechanics models that this refers to, that is, lattice spin systems and field theories with a small proportion of random non-local connections. Okay. And I'm actually not going to use this much in this talk, but one might make the hypothesis that the dislocations are randomly distributed up to the Hubble scale. I'll mention later, just briefly, why that's there. Okay. So one query is how much of this could we tolerate? And this is not a talk about that, but I just invite people to think about it and ask, you know, supposing that there's some fundamental discrete structure to space, and it almost, it has locality properties which almost match, you know, some big three-sphere or three-plane in a Friedman-Robertson-Walker model, but there's a small density of non-local connections. So there, let's say that is, say, in a graphical model, there would be sort of one node per Planck volume. So what proportion of those nodes could be the origin of such non-local connections that go randomly to somewhere else in the Hubble scale? And to make the problem interesting, let's assume that the probability of a quanta which doesn't carry a conserved quantum number, like a photon, of tunneling across one of those is Newton's constant, that the rate is Newton's constant times the energy cubed, which is what you would get dimensionally and what you get if you try to make a model and work it out. So something with Chanda that we've been discussing is, how bad could it be? That is, could there be one per cubic meter, one per cubic centimeter, one per cubic parsec, before it would violate something that we observe? Or maybe even one per cubic Fermi, which is still a density of 10 to the minus 60 for these dislocations. So you can go all the way to one of these non-local ends per cubic Fermi and still be in a regime where there's a very small parameter that describes the disordering from non-locality, which is 10 to the minus 60. And so you still can do a kind of perturbation theory. Okay. Well, Yudin here did such a study. And what he did was take the Ising model in two dimensions, disorder the structure of the lattice that it was on by a small proportion of non-local connections, and study what happened to the thermodynamics of the Ising model. And the interesting thing is, not much. The Curie temperature increases slightly. And I'm just summarizing what was a lot of work, a lot of results. The correlation functions still match, assuming that you scale them for the increase in the Curie temperature. And it would therefore be hard for an observer to detect those by measuring correlation functions, to detect that there was a small proportion of non-locality. So maybe it's there. How would it get there, this non-locality? Well, from some version, if you believe now in some version, and these things are very generic, but I'll refer to loop quantum gravity because that's a place where we know we have models for the dynamics. But these things are much more generic. Supposing we start with a quantum state of the universe when it's very small, below the scale where the classical limit should be playing a role. At that scale, it's hard to imagine that the quantum state knows that this graph, which is evolving quantum dynamically, should approximate any three-dimensional manifold. So let's assume it's random. And then it evolves by the moves, the dynamical moves in quantum gravity. I'm hoping for a piece of chalk somewhere. So those moves are of two kinds. What we call expansion moves, for example, a triangle, a node goes to a triangle. There are also contraction moves, which are the reverse, and exchange moves. Exchange, which are connected by an edge, exchange who they're connected, how they're connected to the rest of the thing. So these are expansion. I'm sorry, they both start off with EX. And these are exchange. And basically, in spin foam models and loop quantum gravity models, one has different amplitudes for those kind of moves acting on graphs. So if you start with note these moves are local microscopically. If you start with a random graph and act many times with them, these will grow the graph, and these replace a node with a local structure. And these sort of disorder local structures. So you might think or hope that the dynamics will tend towards a local graph, that is a graph that has a nice embedding in a low-dimensional manifold. Okay, so it's, since you guys working on quantum computers are going too slowly, we can't run the experiment on a quantum computer, but we can run a stochastic form of the experiment, that is, give probabilities, start with a random graph and give probabilities to these different evolution moves and see what universality classes get generated. And this was done by Hal Finkel, who was a student last summer. And there's no quantum mechanics, there's no labels on the graphs. He starts with a random graph of about 200 nodes, and he evolves them with combinations of these. And the important parameter in the models turns out to be R, which is the probability of an exchange move at each step over the probability of an expansion move. That turns out to be the key parameter in the models. And I'll show you some of the results. We were hoping to find some kind of critical behavior and in the critical regime to see the emergence of local structures. And that's not what was seen. So there's a... He has a criteria for local and non-local. An edge is local if it's part of a small loop, if there's somewhere a closed cycle of edges which is small, and small here means 5 or less, which is appropriate for low-dimensional lattices. And so randomly, you get many local ones, which are the red ones, and some non-local ones, which are the magenta ones. That's 200 nodes. If you evolve them at R equals 0, so all expansion moves, you get things like that. Okay. And he's measured the statistical properties of the connectivities, the Hausdorff dimensions, and so forth. And these look nothing like manifolds of any dimension. And that's actually depressing news for some versions of loop quantum gravity, where the dynamics are only expansion moves and their inverses. Okay, so green ones are non-local edges which come from links that were added. And blacks are local edges, which come from things that the move added. No. It's a parameter. He runs a stochastic evolution, varying the ratio of these two, how often he makes one of these moves as opposed to one of these moves. He chose R equals 0. Yeah, it's a parameter. OK, that's a close-up. There's nothing that looks local there, and you can characterize that by studies of Hausdorff dimension correlation functions. There's nothing that looks local, and there's nothing that looks like a manifold in there. It's spiky, and this is, in fact, a well-known problem. This is called the C equals 1 catastrophe in other language in conformal field theory. This is spikes growing on spikes growing on spikes. It's a catastrophe which is well understood in various statistical models of geometry. If you dominate the expansion moves, then you disorder the structure, the connectivities, much more often than you grow them. And you get something that at first sight looks like a manifold. But when you study it, you see that it's dominated by those green edges, which are edges that were added by the evolution but are not part of any small cycle. That's what it looks like blown up. So you get rid of the spikiness problem. But you don't solve the problem of the emergence of locality. And I can refer to his paper for details. And indeed, there is evidence of two phases. That's a particular observable, which is the small scale Hausdorff dimension as opposed to R. And you can see that as soon as you're above R about 50, it doesn't matter much to further increase R. So there really are two phases. That didn't come out. But the tentative conclusion is that you never recover locality. I'm going a little more slowly than I wanted to, but I think this is OK, because this is worth describing anyway. OK. I'm going to skip, however, there's an argument about why you don't come to locality, and basically it's because you can make non-local moves of this kind, where this is one of the non-local edges, and that breeds more non-local edges. So in fact, and you can understand, at least in an estimation, why you evolve to a stable configuration where there actually is a constant density of proportion of non-local edges. But I'll skip that. So if you take this seriously, we have to confront the problem of non-locality. There are three options. One of them is that this is bad. There's something fundamental about locality. There's something fundamental about background dependence. Background independent models fail because they don't restore locality. And I think that's an option. A second option, the non-locality is there, but stabilizes at a small enough level that it's not manifestly in disagreement with the idea that low energy fields propagate locally in some notion of a low dimensional manifold. But then there should be physical effects coming from the idea that one way to model this is to say we're doing quantum field theory or quantum field theory in an expanding universe, and we just pick random pairs of points within the Hubble scale, and we identify them. And that's the only unconventional thing we do. Are there observable effects? Asking this question was where the stuff about, at least one direction, the stuff about braids and prions came from in the work with Fotini and David Krebs. And there's work in progress investigating cosmological implications of this, which I'm not going to talk about. The rest of the talk is to connect this with the first part of the talk and say maybe the fundamental theory which underlies quantum mechanics is some statistical description of a combinatorial fundamental theory which is not quantum mechanical, and both the notion of geometry and the notion of quantum mechanics arises from it. Okay, and so this is the basic idea that I've now motivated. So 3/4 of the talk was motivation, but I hope it's interesting. And then I'll tell you briefly some results about this. Okay, so the fundamental theory, well, this really all I've said. The fundamental theory is hypothesized to be combinatorial, and some appropriate approximate notion of locality emerges, as does quantum mechanics. Now, there are several claims from the emergence of quantum mechanics from a theory where the degrees of freedom are more fundamental degrees of freedom treated statistically or stochastically. There's the work of Ed Nelson from the 60s. There's more recently a lot of work by Steve Adler and collaborators. We had a paper with Fotini about this, and Artem here had a paper about this, and there are others. So what I'm interested to do first is investigate, are these really working, and can we understand in some general way what's happening in these approaches and why they work? Because it does seem strikingly impossible that there could be some system that has a classical description whose statistical mechanics leads to an approximation by quantum mechanics. I think the people here in Foundations of Quantum Mechanics are skeptical and have a right to be skeptical. So the result of reflection about this is that this can only work if four principles are satisfied. And this is the key conclusions of the talk. And then the rest, which I'll do as much as people are interested in, are technical work to demonstrate these conclusions. So we imagine a setup, let me just make this precise, where there are originally a set of degrees of freedom which are not in space and not quantum mechanical. There are some average degrees of freedom or subsystem degrees of freedom, there are two different ways of doing that, which are identified as V2B quantum observables. And averaging is performed over the other degrees of freedom, and to a certain approximation, the theory that governs those subsystem observables is shown to be quantum mechanics. So the first condition is that the effect of averaging over the non-local, non-subsystem degrees of freedom is to induce a noise in the subsystem degrees of freedom. which is universal. That is, there's a diffusion constant, and there's a universal noise in all the local degrees of freedom. Okay? This means that the subsystem degrees of freedom have to be treated by stochastic differential equations. Second, in spite of the fact that the interaction, so you can imagine this is analogous to what we do all the time in thermodynamics, where there's a subsystem and a reservoir and an interaction between them. Here's how it's different. It's different first in that even though the subsystem is in interaction with the larger system, there's an average conserved energy. There's a quantity which is defined in the statistical mechanics, which is an averaged energy which is conserved in time. That doesn't tend to happen in thermodynamics. That's point two. Point three, the effect of the fluctuations of the system degrees of freedom on the subsystem degrees of freedom does not induce a breakdown of the of time reversal invariance. This is the most important thing, new conclusion. The time reversal invariance has to be strictly maintained. Otherwise, you don't get quantum mechanics. And that's the hidden thing inside of Nelson that makes it work. And last, we keep only terms of lowest order in the classical variables and their derivatives. So it's effective field theory. OK. We start a little bit late. I think I have, do I have 15 minutes? OK. OK. So two slides on the language of stochastic differential equations, then how Nelson, then I'll express those four conditions in the language of stochastic differential equations, and I'll derive quantum mechanics for you. And probably the rest of the talk can be postponed to another time. Okay. So in stochastic differential equations, there are some degrees of freedom x, a configuration space that they label, a time t, and a probability density rho, and a probability current v, which is a vector field in the configuration space. There is the current conservation law, which is assumed. The probability is normalized to 1. And now what it means to describe a stochastic differential equation is described in this equation here. Dx refers to the following. In a moment of time dt, you have an ensemble of trajectories which are at some point x at time t. And we're measuring an average forward derivative. So we go to a time t plus delta t. The thing to do is to look down here, go to time t plus delta t, take the difference, which x of t points, divide by delta t, take the average, and then take the limit as delta t goes to 0 from the future. And that's called the average future derivative. And another way to say that is that there's an ensemble of trajectories, and on them, there's a variable on the ensemble, the differential in the finite time dt, where there's an averaged, an averaged forward velocity b and a fluctuation dw. And dw satisfies the statistics of Brownian motion with a constant nu. Similarly, one can go into the past. So this averaged velocity is b. Similarly, one can go into the past to time t minus delta t, average over the ensemble, divide, and then take the limit. And you get an averaged backward velocity, which does not need to be equal to the average forward velocity, because the paths in the ensemble are generically not differentiable, because they're subject to a Brownian motion with statistics where dx is proportional square root of dt. Okay. So that's the way that stochastic differential equations work and stochastic variables work. One then has two important quantities. The current velocity is the average between the forward and the backward average velocity, which means there's a quantity of interest, which is the difference. This is the u is the difference by which the averaging to the future disagrees with the averaging to the past in defining the velocities, and therefore would be 0 if these were all smooth paths where dx squared went like dt squared rather than dt. Instead, this is proportional, and this you show from the basic kinematics written down here, is proportional to the derivative of the log of the probability density. And therefore, a measure of the mismatch of the forward and backward notions of derivatives is related to the gradient of the probability density, and nu again is the diffusion constant there. This is a key equation. Keep your eyes on it. Okay? Now, no, star implies quantities related to averaging to the past rather than averaging to the future. Sorry. Okay. Other ways to get it are to get to the Fokker-Planck equation, from which you directly get this, the probability conservation, current conservation, and the relation that I just told you. Keep your eagle eyes on this relation here. Because I'm interested in time reversal invariance, I note that the forward velocities go to the backward velocities under time reversal with a minus sign. Current conservation, the current velocity goes to minus of itself, but this osmotic velocity, so-called, goes to itself under time reversal because it's related to quantities of one time. Yes. The U's, who are the Q's? The Q, sorry, the Q is just the metric on the configuration space. The W's, you mean the fluctuations on the previous? No, the W's are the statistical fluctuations. They're not necessarily independent of the B's, if that's what you're asking. Although I'm a little bit, let's come back to that when we see what happens with them. Okay, so here is how to understand Nelson's dynamics. And this is equivalent to what was in Nelson's paper, but is in a language that lets us think about effective low energy physics. So we want an averaged Hamiltonian to describe our stochastic system that I've just given the language for. That averaged Hamiltonian has to be a function of the quantities that describe the stochastic dynamics, which are the probability density and the current velocity. Everything else is a function of these two. We want the averaged Hamiltonian to be conserved in time. We want it to be invariant under time reversal invariance. We want it only to keep terms that dominate in the low velocity and long wavelength limit. We want, this is a condition I haven't mentioned, but it's sort of part of that one, which is we want the current velocity to be irrotational. If it has any curl, you imagine that you just go take some energy out of the system and that turbulence goes away and it becomes curl free. Okay. H, I'm going to require to be positive definite and invariant under rotations, and it should be local on the configuration space. That is, this averaged Hamiltonian is an integral on the configuration space of a Hamiltonian density, H script tilde, and that has to be a density because we're not making use of any other structure. So it has to be proportional to the probability density, which is the only density, I mean density in the sense of differential geometry, is the only density in the problem. And then there's a scalar function H, which is a local scalar function. And the rules that we've given are enough to determine H. So first, that's what I already said. So H is just a function. It can just be a function. It's a scalar, so it can only be a function of scalars. And we only have two scalars in the problem, which is the current velocity, V, and this osmotic velocity, U. The only other quantity in the problem is rho, which is a density, which can't go into a scalar. Time reversal invariance and positive definiteness restricts us to H being a function of the current velocity squared, the osmotic velocity squared, their dot product, then squared. Could be just a function of position, which is going to give a potential energy, and then terms and derivatives. That's time reversal invariance. The low velocity limit of that and low derivative limit of that is that H, which is the energy of a member of this ensemble at a point in the configuration space X, has a term proportional to the current velocity squared. I mean, that makes sense, but this is not the velocity of individual trajectory. It's the current velocity of the ensemble. And it has a term proportional to the osmotic velocity squared. OK, Okay, with some free constant B. So what does what? Neglecting derivatives of these quantities. Now, if I set B to 0, this is just the statistical description of some particles obeying Newton's laws in the configuration space. So the scene of the crime is the term proportional to B. And I told you to keep your eagle eyes on the U, which is related. It's a measure of the difference between averaging to the future and the past, and it's related to the derivative of the log of the probability density. So keep your eyes on this term. This has to be where anything which is not classical physics comes from. We now impose the condition that the current velocity is curl free. That tells us it's the gradient of some scalar function s. It's nice to put the constant m in there, but it doesn't really matter. So putting everything together, this is the expression for the average conserved energy in the long wavelength, small velocity limit, where U is a potential energy and everything else has been defined. Okay, so those four principles that I gave lead to that expression with B a free parameter and nu the constant measuring the scale of the Brownian motion or the noise. So we now impose that that time derivative of that is 0. It's an elementary calculation. We use the current conservation, and we get that equation. And if I wasn't running slow on time, I would go through that with you, but it's completely elementary. So we get an equation that, look at this, starts like the Hamilton-Jacobi equation for S, which is, after all, a function on the configuration space. And then we get these two extra terms involving derivatives of the probability density with this constant B and the scale of the noise nu in front of them. So that's the new stuff. That's, and by the way, from positive definiteness, B has to be positive. We have current conservation, and those two equations are the real and imaginary parts of the Schrodinger equation. If I define a wave function to be the square root of the probability density times e to the I s, natural because you started the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. So this was Schrodinger's idea just in reverse, okay, over h bar, where h bar is this combination of elementary constants. And you see when if b were 0, h bar would be 0, and we would be back to classical physics. Okay. So I just gave you a derivation of quantum mechanics from statistical mechanics. Now, did I pull the wool over your eyes? Okay. Let's look at what happened in this term. Okay. What happened in this term is we start writing, that is the term with the b's in it, that with the proportional to b, we wrote the the average energy as the probability density in configuration space times a function which we took to be the energy of a particle at that point in configuration space. In ordinary statistical mechanics, the energy at a point in statistical in configuration space does not depend itself on the probability density. That's making the properties of an individual particle depend on the probability distribution or the ensemble. Okay. So if we were doing classical physics, we could not have written down this term, B, with the B in front of it, the B U squared term. Could not be there in ordinary statistical physics because it implies that the energy at a point in configuration space depends on the probability distribution. So that's how Nelson, if you will, pulled the wool over our eyes. Either, and Nelson did it through a different route in which he defined acceleration, which I'll mention in a minute, but it's equivalent to what he did. Either we accept that the energy of a system at a point in configuration space can depend on the probability distribution, in which case we might as well be doing Bohmian mechanics, because that's explicitly true in Bohmian mechanics. Or we derive this from a more fundamental theory. Okay. Now, let me summarize because I want to be closing soon. The next configuration is, can you derive this from a more fundamental theory? Okay. And let me just say what the key point is. The key point is, you can. So I wrote down a Hamiltonian description of a fundamental theory with the system variables and the extra variables, and asked, could we, by averaging over the effects of the extra variables, the so-called non-local variables, induce that term proportional to the U squared, okay, coming from averaging over more fundamental variables? Okay. And the answer is that we can. And let me see if I can get to the key point. The key point is that I have to define the average of a kinetic energy here, where x is the particle in the configuration space, but its velocity could also depend on the hidden variables y, and I want to get an average kinetic energy by averaging over the hidden variables. Okay. And the problem is that when I take the hidden variables, if the hidden variables are fixed, the dynamics is deterministic, and the velocity means something. But once I average over the hidden variables, because it induces noise, the velocities are going to become ill-defined. So if I back up and imagine there's a discretization in time, okay, I have to, well, first of all, I have freedom in how I do the discretization in time. I can go forward to, I can average to the future and average to the past. And the key point, and this is the last thing, is that it matters how you do that. It matters how you do that discretization, because we have to exchange the order of the limit in which the time dts go to zero and the averaging over the hidden variables, because the hidden variables induce noise and Brownian motion, after which the limit doesn't exist. So we have to exchange the order of the limits and the integral. And when we do that, it turns out to matter whether we define the differentials in time symmetrically under time reversal invariance or not. That is, we were always careful to be averaging symmetrically future time derivatives and past time derivatives. And when we do that, then we reproduce quantum mechanics. Okay, let me see if there's a slide I can start on, stop on. Okay. So the conclusion is that quantum mechanics could be derived from a more fundamental non-local theory as envisioned by Nelson and other people, but only under two very strict conditions, which are really the key conditions. And if you imagine your subsystem is in contact with the rest of the world, which is functioning as a reservoir, one, there has to be an average conserved energy for the subsystem as a whole, in spite of the fact that the interaction with the reservoir leads to noise. And two, the effect of that noise must be symmetric under time reversal, so that when you perform the averaging over the hidden variables, you don't do what normally happens in thermodynamics, which is induce break time reversal invariance and get an effective thermodynamic theory, which is not time reversal invariance. So the conclusion is that some very special things have to be true if quantum mechanics is an approximation to a more fundamental theory. We can make models where we build those conditions in, but you're also entitled at this point to say that it's artificial, or at least to be impressed by the delicateness of what's required to derive quantum mechanics from a statistical system, and therefore come to the conclusion, could quantum mechanics be derived from a more fundamental theory? Yes, if delicate conditions are imposed or somehow are realized in nature, but otherwise, no. So thank you.
What I'm going to say. So you've stated several times that under certain conditions that you've discussed, you get quantum mechanics. But you don't. You get, so assuming that that velocity field that you mentioned is irrotational, the wave function that you construct by writing as the square root of the density times e to the is is necessarily a complex valued function with no nodes, because if you went around the node, the gradient of the phase would be non-zero. And this is a problem that was pointed out by Wallström in 1995, and nobody's answered it yet. So what you, I mean, what you've done here is you've got the quantum mechanics of nodeless wave functions, which is a set of measure zero in the set of quantum states.
Okay, so as you can tell, this is a discussion that's been going on for about several years among several of us here. Let me briefly indicate what the objection is in a simplified case, which is not the general case, I want to emphasize, but a simplified case. And then let's not argue about it once again here in front of everybody, but let's let other people join in. Okay. So the case, the simplified case, is quantum mechanics on a circle, where you can apply the Nelsonian approach in quantum mechanics on a circle. Let me not take you through the equations. You can solve Nelson's equations that I described the derivation of. There's a one solution is a constant density, probability density, and any probability current going around the circle W. This isn't a case without a potential. Yeah. Okay. So you can, and then you can write down the wave function for, there's a solution to Nelson's equation for any current velocity. The current velocity is not quantized, which is the point that Anthony is raising. And therefore, the wave function that you get is discontinuous at one point on the circle, the way I wrote it at theta equals zero. Okay. And the answer is that, so what? The Hilbert space is L2 of the circle, and L2 of the circle is full of discontinuous wave functions. And because of that, there would have to be such solutions to Nelson's equation if it was a correspondence. Then somebody can say, but wait a minute, that discontinuity might mean that the Hamiltonian isn't defined in quantum mechanics. So maybe these are unphysical because they don't have a well-defined energy or have an infinite energy. But Nelson's formulation starts with an averaged notion of energy, which is completely finite and well-defined. So let me take another question, unless people want to talk about it. I think the issue is, what happens in more complicated cases with higher dimensional configuration spaces with nodes which could appear anywhere in the wave function? And I think we don't know the answer, but that gives the simplest illustration of what this issue is.
You didn't say so very much about how the non-local theory is actually realized. So I wonder what happens to the non-local interactions within the subsystem.
The subsystem has to be small enough that the non-local interactions can be neglected. And that gives a... So if the probability of a node having a non-local connection on it, to go back to that class of models, is P. P has to be small enough that the probability is vanishingly small that within subsystems where we do experiments, there are pairs of points which are connected by these non-local connections. There could be a few, but there can't be so many that we would detect in the laboratory violations of locality, or we would detect violations of the speed of light being constant and so forth. And there is enormous room in the parameter P for that, because the universe is so big. That is, if you can ask, if only 1 out of 10 to the 60 nodes have a non-local connection in them, and that's down at the Planck scale, that's 1 per cubic Fermi. But the size of the smallest volume that will have two points connected is I think tens of cubic kilometers, if I remember right. Somebody can do the arithmetic. I can't do the arithmetic in my head so fast. But so there is a regime that realizes that, which is a pretty impressive regime. That is, if there could be, and I'm not saying that there, you know, I'm not positing this, but it seems like there could be such an enormous density of non-local connections, and because the Hubble scale, if they go randomly to points within the Hubble scale, because the Hubble scale is so much bigger than our laboratories, you could have a high density of ends, and within any Earth-bound laboratory, all the ends end up outside the solar system.
A lot of emphasis was placed on having time reversal invariance, but we have experiments in the K meson and B meson systems that suggest maybe we have a non-time reversal invariant world. So how much can that knob be tweaked? I mean, it seems to me it would be attractive to try and make adjustments there.
I never thought about that. That's a really good idea. Never thought about that. So the question is, can we propose an experiment? Well, some of us are working on that. And at the conference some weeks ago, I was foolish enough to describe some work in progress with Chandan Fotini about dark energy. So that's an attempt to do that. But that work, I agree that that's absolutely essential. And if we come to something that convinces us, we will post it. Your microphone is not on.
Saying that, it seems to me that you are not being ambitious enough. You started out your motivation saying that there is this problem, measurement problem, and then we should worry about that and so on and so forth. But another major problem that worries many people is the non-locality. And it seems to me that your starting point was that the world must be non-local because quantum mechanics seems to say so, which is true. You can't complete quantum mechanics with locally causal theory. But you are changing the rules of the game. You're changing, you want a completely new theory whereby quantum mechanics emerges as an approximate theory. So then why just not go a step further and start with a local theory and then hope to receive or get non-local theory?
I'm not sure what you mean by that, but look, let me make a weak argument, okay? But I think a reasonable argument. 99% of the work on quantum gravity from all the different approaches assumes that quantum mechanics is fundamental, is given, and the job is to apply it to some form of gravity, whether it's string theory, loop quantum gravity, causal sets, et cetera. I mean, quantum mechanics may be modified slightly, but basically quantum mechanics is assumed. And there's the 1% people like Roger Penrose, Gerard Atoff, Steve Adler, Anthony, who take the other point of view and say maybe, and I think I've heard you advocate this point of view sometimes, maybe one should modify quantum mechanics to fit space-time into it. And so this is an attempt in that direction. And it's one of several attempts in that direction. And what I pointed to, what interests me, is two things. One of them is the possibility of John's question, that is an experimental regime, because there are mysteries in cosmology that that there are, don't seem to be really good answers to, like dark energy and the cosmological constant. So there is an opportunity there. And the other thing is there is an existing difficulty in different approaches to quantum gravity. And then I want to emphasize all of them, you know, including M-theory and matrix models. As soon as you get background independent, there is a serious difficulty getting back locality. So that's the part of the talk which I really want to emphasize. That's a serious difficulty. We don't worry about it enough. And one option, which is Fotini's option, which I'm trying to investigate here, is that maybe those effects are really there. That is, maybe we're not succeeding at deriving local low-energy physics from these different approaches because it's not the right answer. Maybe the right answer is semi-local or locality with some distortions and disordering in it. And then that opens up an opportunity with respect to quantum mechanics. It probably, again, it's, you know, it's probably a will of the wisp, but it seems like it's worth pursuing a little bit.
Quantum mechanics. There are many mysteries related to wave functions and measurement, but I think that even the biggest one relates to spin a half. And so the question is anything known about statistical mechanics of Grassmann variables? And do you have any reason to suspect that you could ever get a theory of quantum mechanical spin a half from some more fundamental underlying basis?
There is a subject in which, there is a literature in which spin one half particles are studied in Bohm, in Nelson, and so forth. And I'm not very much of an expert on any of those things. I think that there are papers, and you should look at them. I haven't seen anything that's. Let me not characterize it. There are papers and people have attempted. There's a question up there. Could you turn the microphone on?
Possibilities of implications in the context of quantum computation. So if you have some classical system underlying or when averaged bringing up quantum mechanics, then either this means a classical simulation of quantum mechanics, or it means that you will need an underlying classical system which is exponentially bigger. And that seems to me a little unlikely, because especially in statistical physics, averaging properties usually emerge logarithmically fast and not exponentially slow. So the second possibility seems unlikely to me. And so it seems that what you're actually suggesting is that any such successful scheme would lead to efficient classical simulations of quantum mechanics. Is that correct?
That's a very good question, and you've asked it before, and I don't know that I have a better idea than previously. It's a natural question to ask from the sense side of quantum information theory. Two things. One. Probably useless. Okay. The hypothesis is that the completion of quantum mechanics in terms of a realistic theory, not necessarily deterministic, I didn't use determinism anywhere, but with realistic ontology, okay, is possible only in the context of a cosmological theory. That's the hypothesis here. The universe is, there is a lot of room there. Now, whether there's enough room to get all the exponential information in Hilbert space, I don't know, but at least it's plausible. The second thing is is I've never really understood how that argument pans out in the case of either Bohm or Nelson. And I think it would be really good to develop that. Maybe somebody knows. But that is, it does look like, and it is done, I have seen classical computers simulating Bohmian mechanics and getting interference patterns and so forth out. So good. Okay. Okay. Okay, thank you. Oh, I should have the last word. On the technical point that is it in discussion here, I disagree, but that's a technical point. I'm not going to belabor people with the technical point. I think that is the challenge. And I think, let me turn it around and put it the other way. I think the only plausible, realist completion of quantum mechanics is something that is explicitly cosmological. And therefore, there will be new effects having to do with the amount of information in the Hilbert space of a subsystem versus the amount of information in connections between a subsystem and the rest of the cosmology. And one should look for new effects that may be there in various, that is, if this is right, then as a system gets bigger, we don't get to look at all its Hilbert space. That is, in a sense, what Anthony is saying is right. I mean, I think for one particle, for a few particles, there isn't that much room in Hilbert space, and we can imagine non-local physical information, non-local connections to the rest of the universe. Recoding that in a large subsystem, there's an enormous amount of information in Hilbert space, which is what Dorit was saying, and it may be that in such a theory can, that is, that the limits coming from this kind of theory will become experimentally relevant. And that's one reason, perhaps, to try to develop this, because the experimental limits may be accessible.